A bloc of West African countries has ordered the new military junta in Niger to step down. One problem with the message, though, a lack of unity among the members.
It's a house that is divided against itself.
Also ahead, all those Barbenheimer memes on the internet not going over well in Japan.
That's been received as particularly bad taste because it seemed to be trivializing the story of the atomic bomb.
How Japanese cinema tells the story of the bombs differently. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Plus, health officials in Australia are celebrating. HIV transmission has been virtually eliminated in parts of Sydney, once a hotspot for new cases.
There's no one more thrilled than I am that we've reached this stage. I am just ecstatic.
How they accomplished it and what the rest of the world can learn, those stories and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler in for Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. Yesterday marked the deadline for leaders of Niger's military coup to step down and restore the democratically elected government. Instead, thousands of supporters of the coup gathered in a stadium in the capital of Niamey. They waved the flag of Niger and Russia and cheered the military coup leaders on stage. Oluwole Ojewale is with the Institute for Security Studies in Dakar, Senegal. Oluwole, it was the 15-member Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, that set that deadline I mentioned for the junta to restore the elected leader. That deadline came and went with no military action. What does that tell us about ECOWAS's willingness to get involved here?
The obvious thing is that ECOWAS is a divided house now, and it's a division of ideas, division of what path you think a country should go, whether it should go in the direction of authoritarianism or it should go in the direction of democracy. There's a coup now made up of four countries: Guinea, Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger. They stand on the one side representing the rise of authoritarianism in the region. And then the second side, which is comprising of 11 countries, are standing for democracy. So apparently there's a division already in terms of the direction that ECOWAS countries want to go. And that is what is playing out now.
So two ECOWAS members, Burkina Faso and Mali, that are now led by juntas, are providing some of this division within ECOWAS. What is their position?
Their position is that ECOWAS must not deploy force against Niger to restore democracy in the country. And if ECOWAS declares war against Niger, they will also take it as declaring war against Mali, declaring war against Burkina Faso, and they want to stand in solidarity with Niger.
Niger's ousted prime minister commented on this all in an interview with Reuters yesterday. He's currently in exile in Europe. He said that there's no troops from Mali or Burkina Faso on the border. Instead, there's Islamist militants. He basically says the armies of these two countries aren't likely to be much help to the Niger junta. What's your reaction to that assessment?
I agree completely. The rhetorics from the Malian junta and the Burkina Faso junta, they are mere military propaganda. Because these are the same set of people that have not been able to ward off insurgency, Islamist group, jihadist group, and terrorist group in their country.
The update this morning is that ECOWAS is holding a summit on Thursday. What do you expect that meeting to accomplish?
The whole world has been waiting, thinking that the 7 days ultimatum that is just passing or that has just passed is probably going to give rise to the deployment of military into Niger. But I think if you look at the preponderance of public opinion and sentiment in the region now, considering the instability in the Sahel and multiple insurgencies, a lot of people have the view that adding a new layer of war is going to complicate security in the region. That is the one thing. And the second thing is the fact that, like in the case of Nigeria, there's been a strong resistance from the Senate. And I think probably that is also going to play out in some of the ECOWAS countries. So that leaves ECOWAS with only one option that is viable, and it is the option of diplomatic negotiation to see the restoration of democracy in the country.
So with some ECOWAS members supporting the junta in Niger, is the group really able to move decisively to reinstall the democratic government?
Nobody can predict how this thing is going to last in the coming days. And I think the biggest task now is to make sure that this military regime do not form a new bloc of authoritarianism in the region so that they create a subdivision between countries that stand for democracy and countries that stand for authoritarianism. They've allowed that. the potential concern of most people is that there can be neighborhood effects of other countries falling into the hand of junta in the region.
Oluwole Ojewale is with the Institute for Security Studies in Dakar, Senegal. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Every 4 years, teens from more than 150 countries convene for the World Scout Jamboree. Tens of thousands of campers create a huge tent city. It's meant to celebrate a global spirit of friendship and adventure. This year's Jamboree, held in South Korea, is disbanding in shambles. In recent days, many of the scouts have been overwhelmed by extreme heat. Others have contracted COVID. And now, as Typhoon Kanun barrels toward South Korea's coastline, authorities are evacuating all the scouts from the campsite early. Vincent Blood's stepdaughter is at the event. We reached him in Bournemouth, England. Vincent, your stepdaughter is in the Scouts. It used to be back in the day the Boy Scouts. Now it's open to both boys and girls. So tell us about your stepdaughter's experience.
She went over to the event, and before they went to the campsite, they spent, I think it was 4 days in the capital in Seoul. And that was all good, though there were a couple of red flags. We knew that the site had been flooded 2 weeks before the event, and we thought, how can this place be flooded by a monsoon and then you get a superb world-class event ready within the space of 2 weeks? There's just not enough time. And then they had to delay for 1 day traveling there because they said things still aren't quite good. She arrived at the site. The first thing that happened, unfortunately for her, she sprained her ankle really badly. She had to wait for 3 days to see just an emergency first aid medic. So this wasn't like a full hospital look at her ankle, like with x-rays and the kind of things she really needed, because she was in a lot of pain. They just wrapped a really tight bandage around the ankle and sent her off on crutches. Of course, the site was so uneven that unfortunately she struggled so much she ended up coming down with heat stroke and collapsing.
So
after another day they rushed her off to the hotel in Seoul just to get her away from the camp and into like a cool air-conditioned hotel. And about that time they pulled all of the UK scouts. They just decided, okay, we've had enough here. I'm sure you've heard the kind of horror stories about the illness, the heat stroke. There was loads of bugs and insects which were scaring some of the scouts. There were dirty showers, rubbish wasn't being collected. So it wasn't the experience they were expecting.
So this sounds like quite the ordeal. How is your stepdaughter holding up?
Thankfully, we got good news this morning. She got to the hospital in Seoul, had an x-ray. There may be a slight bone chip, but it's nothing too serious. She's now got a proper, like a boot with straps to support all her ankle. So we're hoping now that she can at least enjoy the last part of the visit, because they're going to reorganize and do events within the capital, within Seoul. Hopefully it'll be just a little bit of light at the end of what's been a pretty dark tunnel for her.
Yeah, it's good to hear she got the care she needed. It's kind of strikes me as just a tinge ironic that this organization, that in the U.S. at least, their motto is be prepared. It sounds like they were not prepared for this event. Do you blame anyone or any group of people for how things turned out at the Jamboree? Or is this all just kind of acts of God and nature?
We're not really blaming the British contingent. We believe they did very good preparation. I mean, 18 months prior to the event, when she was selected, she's gone on training camps every couple of months. I think the blame is more than likely going to fall on a combination of the Korean government officials and also the Korean scouting community for not organizing it correctly. But you don't really like to point the finger too soon until facts have been established. We feel sorry for all the parents of the kids, not just in the UK, but around the world. They put their hearts into this event. Yeah, for it all to fall apart like that, it's very sad.
Do you think your stepdaughter will stick with scouting after this whole ordeal?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. As I say, it was just the conditions out there were just so severe, really. I think they weren't anticipating having 35 degrees of heat. That's a lot, and high humidity to go with it.
Yeah, that's 95 degrees Fahrenheit, plus the humidity, as you say. That's a lot for kids who aren't used to that climate. Vincent Blood is in Bournemouth, England. He's been telling us the saga of his stepdaughter, who suffered from a sprained ankle and then heat exhaustion at the World Scout Jamboree in South Korea. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
The final survivors in Europe from a drug scandal dating back more than half a century are finally being compensated, partially at least. The drug was thalidomide. During the 1950s, doctors prescribed the sedative to pregnant women to reduce nausea. Tens of thousands of so-called thalidomide babies were born with congenital disorders, from shortened or missing limbs to damaged internal organs. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
While chatting in her living room, Josefina Montpeo accidentally drops her glasses on the floor. Montpeo's confined to a wheelchair, legless, so picking things up is complicated. That's where Mushu comes in. Mushu is Montpeo's Basque sheepdog, trained to retrieve fallen objects, to turn on lights. He opens doors for me, Montpeo says, scratching Mushu's scruffy gray head. He can open drawers and bring me my medicine, she says. He can even throw stuff in the trash for me. All of this is hugely helpful because Montpeo, 64 years old and a widow, lives alone. Thalidomide deprived her of her legs, left one arm deformed, her spine fractured and crooked. In the 1950s, a German laboratory called Grünenthal hailed its new thalidomide as a wonder drug, but it was never properly tested. The result, birth defects in tens of thousands of people across the continent. There are victims in North America, too, following short-lived clinical trials. By 1962, thalidomide was off the market. The scandal led to stricter drug testing around the world. As for victims, governments and Grünenthal compensated most of them, but the hundreds in Spain went ignored. Spain's different, says 56-year-old retiree Silvia San Salvador. You could say that Spain's from another galaxy, she jokes. San Salvador is with Spain's Association of Thalidomide Victims. There are around 150 members. She was born with two stunted arms that bent the wrong way, missing fingers, and a partially developed nose. By the time she was 12, she'd had seven surgeries, none of them via Spain's public healthcare system, because in Spain, San Salvador explains, thalidomide never existed officially. All of this happened under the dictator Francisco Franco, she says, and the dictatorship would not admit it had allowed in a medicine that caused birth defects, so the subject, she says, was never even broached. Nor were women warned, even as the evidence of thalidomide's dangers mounted. San Salvador knew the cause of her condition. She still has her mother's thalidomide prescription, with the stamp from a local pharmacy. But many Spanish victims remained in the dark.
¿Qué tipo de malformaciones produce la talidomida o produjo la talidomida?
Bueno, en principio las que se ven.
Until 2011, Franco was long dead, Spain a democracy. Two thalidomide victims went on this national TV talk show called Teresas. Suddenly, everyone was talking about it. Victims found each other. They organized, sued in Germany, then in Spain, but the statute of limitations had expired. So they lobbied politicians, San Salvador says, dumped medical proof at their feet, said, just look at us. Finally, in 2018, Spain passed a law to help them, and this summer, the government apologized.
En nombre del gobierno de España, quiero pedir perdón a todas las víctimas y a sus familias.
Spain's Minister for Social Rights, Iona Belarra, posted this unofficial mea culpa on Instagram. She said, at long last, victims would receive financial aid to be paid out in 2024. Spanish media have run with it. Europe's last thalidomide victims finally compensated, read headlines. But the story doesn't end here.
No, a ver, no es suficiente, no es suficiente.
It's not enough money, says victim Josefina Montpeo. Also, they're calling it aid. If it were damages, it'd be tax-free. But aid is counted as income, she says, so we're going to have to pay about half back to the government come tax season. Add to that lawyer's fees, she says, and victims will end up with just a third of their payouts. What's a life worth, Montpeo asks, shaking her head. Because the hardest chapter is fast approaching for us. Old age. I'm going to be alone. Spain's thalidomide victims say they'll continue to lobby the government for two things, tax-free compensation and an official apology for being ignored for decades, not just a video post on Instagram. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World. China has the largest navy in the world, but it has only one overseas military base. That's in Djibouti in the Horn of Africa. Soon, though, China will have one more. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports that Beijing is finalizing construction of a second foreign outpost much closer to home.
Off the sandy shores of Cambodia, not far from beach resorts, there is now a giant pier. A pier built so it can handle an aircraft carrier. Cambodia is one of Southeast Asia's poorer countries. It doesn't have an aircraft carrier. But China does, and it's the People's Republic of China, or PRC, that has built up this once basic naval base into something bigger.
It is significant because it's PRC involvement in a military base outside Chinese territory, which is rare.
Blake Herzinger is an analyst with the University of Sydney's United States Studies Center. He says there's been a lot of debate about Cambodia's Ream naval base. China insists it's just adding some infrastructure there, helping out its ally. But the U.S. portrays the build-out as secretive and sinister. Here's what State Department spokesman Ned Price said about the base last year.
We have seen the PRC attempt to put forward a series of shadowy, opaque deals that they would like to see signed in the dead of night with no input or transparency.
Herzinger says the truth is somewhere in the middle.
We're not talking about an enormous military facility. We're not talking about something at the scale that the United States operates in a number of locations around the world.
Locations such as Germany, Japan, Turkey, Kuwait, and more than 70 other countries, some hosting massive U.S. military facilities. Herzinger says China's buildup of this base in Cambodia will allow it to park warships, refuel, resupply, but not much else, such as docking a submarine. And he notes that not long ago, the U.S. built similar facilities at the very same Cambodian base.
10 years ago, we were building facilities and boat ramps and things like that in Ream. Now those things have been torn down and replaced with Chinese investment.
Why did Cambodia choose to team up with China over America? Well, the U.S. constantly criticizes Cambodia for running an authoritarian state. The U.S. also demands the repayment of a $500 million loan, incurred back in the 60s under a totally different Cambodian government. And underneath all that is a dark legacy. The U.S. bombing Cambodia during the Cold War, leaving explosives in the mud that are still maiming civilians. Ken Pia, a Cambodian government-backed policy advisor, told state media recently, when it comes to this naval base, the U.S. is in no position to gripe about who Cambodia partners with. As for what we should do, he says, it's no longer Cambodia's duty to respond to accusations. Rather, this is on the conscience of the accuser, meaning the U.S. Cambodia is insisting this is not a Chinese-only base. In recent statements, officials have said they'll prove it when China's renovations are complete by inviting U.S. warships to dock there, too. For The World, this is Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
If you're looking to add some new recipes to your dinner time rotation, one inexpensive option may be a course at your town's recreation department. In Milwaukee, the offerings are heavy on one particular cuisine. WUWM education reporter Emily Files has the story.
It caught my attention when I was looking through Milwaukee Rec's activity guide last fall. There were so many Korean cooking classes. I wondered why. It's not like Milwaukee is known for its Korean food. Turns out it's because of one woman, a teacher and grandmother in her 60s.
My name is Sonju So. I came from South Korea.
I met Sonju on a recent evening at the local Hamilton High School, where she was getting ready to teach a dozen students how to make beef bulgogi, also known as Korean barbecue. It's marinated thin slices of beef cooked on a stovetop.
Many Korean dishes are very slow food, but very nutrient. Some protein, carbohydrate, some vitamin. I want to introduce about the Korean dishes. And bulgogi is very popular for everybody.
Students start to file in. There are a few couples, a group of friends, and a mother-daughter pair named Gail and Lily Domke. Here's Gail.
Bulgogi I've had it in restaurants before, and it's delicious, and I'd very much like to be able to make that at home. I'd like to learn from somebody that actually knows how to prepare it properly.
Sanju tells the students they'll make the sauce used to marinate the meat. The students get to work chopping onions and scallions and crushing fruit to add to the sauce. Sanju never expected to be a cooking teacher. At age 44, she moved from Seoul to Milwaukee to study early childhood education at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, or UWM. That's when she started to learn English.
It's a little bit hard time, but every day I should take the course, meet the American friends. It's good to learning for my life.
Sanju says her grandmother, who lived past 100, told her, "You're never too old to learn something new." Now Sanju is the teacher. She teaches paper folding arts to school children, and in 2017 started teaching Korean cooking and culture classes through Milwaukee Recreation.
Many American people want to take more and more. They give us some hint or comment. Open the noodle class, open the pancake class like that. So that's a good idea. I will open more and more.
The demand for Korean cooking classes is there, says Claire McHugh, a marketing supervisor with Milwaukee Rec.
Sanju has been a staple here at Hamilton for quite a long time, and I know the staff here love her and are always excited when she, you know, has classes because they're always full, like tonight. So, she's been a really wonderful asset to the program.
Once the vegetables are chopped for the bulgogi class, Sanju lines up the ingredients for the marinade. It includes soy sauce, wine, honey, green onion, garlic, sugar, and more.
Next one, sesame oil, 2 tablespoons.
Sanju submerges thinly sliced beef into her finished marinade. While that sits, the students make their own sauce, commenting on how good it smells. Finally, she puts the marinated beef into the frying pan. After it's cooked, Sanju demonstrates how she eats bulgogi by putting a bite of the meat along with white rice and spicy chili paste on a lettuce leaf used like a spoon to eat. She takes a bite and the students applaud. About 250 Milwaukeeans have learned Korean cooking from Sanju, according to the rec department.
Always my grandma said, the good food is better than medicine. Yeah, so I want to follow her direction.
Sanju is teaching more classes this summer, including bibimbap and fried noodles. They're full, with long wait lists. For The World, I'm Emily Files in Milwaukee.
More stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. The U.S. plans to send Marines to the Persian Gulf to protect commercial ships, playing a potentially dangerous game.
The concerns are obviously significant whenever you have a lot of moving military parts in a very, very small and, you know, risk-prone area.
Plus, goodbye Team USA, hello Team Morocco. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Health officials in Australia are marking a milestone, the virtual elimination of HIV transmission in the inner city area of Sydney. That neighborhood was once the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic in Australia. And now it's the first place in the world to come so close to ending the epidemic. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports from Sydney on what's worked and what other countries can learn.
In 1984, David Paulson was one of the first people in Australia to be diagnosed with HIV. He remembers the moment his doctor gave him the news.
I felt like I was falling down this big, black, bottomless pit. I just was falling. And not only was I told I was going to die, I had this terminal illness, I was also told by the doctor not to tell anyone. Because of the fear, the stigma and discrimination attached to HIV at that time was enormous.
Just a year later, 4,500 gay men in Sydney and Melbourne would be diagnosed with the virus, including many of Paulson's friends. He'd come here to St. Vincent's Hospital in the Darlinghurst area of Sydney to visit them and to get treatment himself.
This was about 1989, I think. I went to visit a friend who was dying, and he was at the end of the ward, and I had to go past all the other rooms. And at that time, there were 6 beds to the room because they were so busy and they had so many patients. And to my horror, in every bed in that ward was someone I knew, either a friend, an acquaintance, or someone I'd worked with. And that was in every bed.
This neighborhood in the gay heart of the city was decimated. Thousands of men died in the 1980s and 90s of AIDS and AIDS-related illnesses. But a lot has changed since then. And last year, there were 11 new cases here. 11. According to data unveiled at the International AIDS Society conference in Brisbane, HIV diagnoses in inner Sydney fell by 88% since 2010. In the rest of Sydney, the decline was smaller, about 31%. Prevention programs haven't been as effective in areas with a lower proportion of gay men. Still, the virtual elimination of HIV in inner Sydney is astonishing, says epidemiologist Andrew Grillick, who presented the findings at the conference.
The World Health Organization through UNAIDS has a goal that we'll end AIDS as a public health threat by 2030, and many people regard that as a pipe dream, impossible.
UNAIDS doesn't define the end of the epidemic as the complete elimination of HIV, because that's impossible without a vaccine or a cure, but as a 90% reduction in new infections.
So this 88% by 2023 is almost there, almost meeting the UNAIDS definition of ending AIDS.
And 8 years ahead of schedule. Grillick says there are several reasons for inner Sydney's progress. One is medication. Antiretroviral drugs can reduce the amount of HIV in a patient's body to levels so low that they can't pass the virus on to others. And a drug known as PrEP, short for pre-exposure prophylaxis, prevents someone from getting HIV in the first place. It's one pill once a day, and in Australia, more than 40% of gay men most at risk of infection are on it. Uptake hasn't been as good in the United States.
Levels of PrEP use are extremely high in Sydney, and that, again, has been mostly working with community and allowing the community organisations to promote it heavily, to having a health system where your doctors know about it and know how to prescribe it, and for it to be affordable to the people who need it.
Yet another reason for Sydney's progress is the country's initial response to the virus back in the 1980s. Australian health authorities were determined not to go down the same path as in the United States, where the Reagan administration was slow to act. Politicians in Australia worked closely with the gay community, sex workers, and IV drug users to come up with strategies that worked, like free condoms, clean needles, community-led sex ed, blunt public health ads like this one from 1987. In it, the Grim Reaper is at a bowling alley. That clanging is the ball. And instead of pins, he's knocking down human bodies. Then the terrifying voiceover.
At first, only gays and IV drug users were being killed by AIDS. But now we know every one of us could be devastated by it.
Dramatic? Yeah. But it did the job. Australia had one of the fastest and most successful responses to HIV/AIDS in the world. Grillick says other countries can learn something from the Australian example, namely, prevention strategies work when they're implemented correctly.
When you act on the scientific evidence within a health framework, you can do it. You know, you can reach these ending AIDS goals.
Back at St. Vincent's Hospital, David Paulson stares up at the building where the AIDS ward used to be. Those beds aren't needed anymore, and in fact, the building's slated to be torn down. Paulson shakes his head, thinking about it.
It's been a long journey, believe me. And there's no one more thrilled than I am that we've reached this stage. I am just ecstatic.
In inner Sydney, the end of the epidemic is no pipe dream after all. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
We've all heard the Hollywood summer buzz.
I don't know if we can be trusted with such a weapon. But we have no choice.
Oppenheimer is dazzling audiences and critics alike here in the U.S., but it's receiving a very different reception in Japan. The film depicts the race to build the atomic bomb, which the U.S., of course, dropped on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II. For more on that reaction in Japan, we're joined by Jennifer Coates. She's a professor of Japan Studies at the University of Sheffield in the U.K. Jennifer, the film Oppenheimer has yet to be released in Japan, but there has been a reaction already. What are people saying?
I mean, I think, as you say, because the film itself hasn't been released, the reaction at the moment is largely to the marketing, particularly, you know, the Barbenheimer marketing phenomenon, which kind of mashes together the Barbie film marketing and the Oppenheimer marketing. And I think that's been received as particularly bad taste, because it seemed to be kind of trivializing the story of the atomic bomb.
Yeah. Do you have any, you know, educated guess as to how the film will be received when it does open in Japan?
It's kind of a complicated one, isn't it? Because I would say that my previous research with Japanese cinema audiences has shown me that, you know, Japanese cinema audiences are still very open to, you know, non-Japanese cinema. Foreign films are very popular. Anything kind of, you know, kind of auteurist, serious, long, beautiful looking, which Oppenheimer obviously is, tends to come across very well. There's also, I think, historically no resistance to foreign-made war films. I do think one of the things that Japanese audiences might have an issue with is the historical accuracy of some elements of the film. It doesn't seem to have been such a huge problem, I think, for English-speaking audiences, that there's a little bit of like historical rewriting. But I can imagine that's going to be a bigger problem in Japan if the film is released there.
How do films created in Japan typically deal with the country's role as an aggressor in World War II or you know, the dropping of these bombs on Japan?
I think that's a really good question, because it's almost the polar opposite. All of the biggest kind of longstanding films made in Japan about the end of the war have focused really closely on the victims of the bombing, which obviously Oppenheimer doesn't do really at all. And while Oppenheimer, I think a lot of people have pointed out, is quite like a male-heavy film, most of the characters are male and you know, members of the armed forces or scientists. On the other hand, in Japan, the largest number of kind of enduringly respected and popular films about the end of the war focus on children and women. And that's obviously a little bit of a maybe deliberate choice, in that it might be easier for audiences to kind of feel sympathy or to really understand the horror of the end of the war when they're watching sort of victim characters who are her children or younger women. You can also even see this in the titles of the films. You know, the popular examples might be Children of Hiroshima, which is a 1952 film by Shindo Kaneto, or Hiroshima itself, which is a 1953 film. There was this kind of huge outpouring of films about atomic bombs.
I'm curious whether the difference in how Japanese and U.S. cinema treats the end of World War II and the atomic bombs differently is a product of, or, you know, related in any way to how those topics are taught in schools. So do the narratives differ when it comes to the U.S. dropping atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki when you're talking about, you know, the Japanese educational system, let's say, versus the U.S.?
I mean, I think that's a really perceptive question, because not only was the U.S.-led occupation in charge of the Japanese educational system for the first 8 years after the war, they really focused on cinema as a tool to educate especially younger audiences. So I think definitely, you know, people who are in their 70s and 80s now sort of went through that schooling system that was very, you know, kind of U.S. occupation informed, and that also really used cinema and film narratives about the war to kind of, I think the word that was used at the time was reorient the Japanese mindset towards a more kind of U.S. style capitalist democratic kind of outlook on life. So I think schooling definitely comes into it. Obviously, we're quite some distance from the end of the Second World War now. And so I think one of the things that we have perhaps seen in Japanese educational channels is what we see, I guess, everywhere, you know, progress and backlash and progress and backlash in kind of a cycle. So there are definitely progressive periods where Japanese school children are encouraged to understand what happened sort of during the war, and particularly Japan's role as aggressor in quite a, I guess, factual and kind of globalized way. And then there will be historical periods where there's kind of backlash and a lot of those references are taken out of history textbooks. And then, of course, campaigners draw attention to that and campaign for them to be put back in. So it's a very live field, I think, the question of how history is taught.
Jennifer Coates is a professor of Japan Studies at the University of Sheffield in the UK. Jennifer, thank you so much for this fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
More than 3,000 U.S. sailors and Marines just arrived in the Middle East. The Pentagon is deploying forces in the Persian Gulf region to send a message to Iran. Iran's military is also expanding its capabilities there, as the world's Shirin Jafari reports.
The Strait of Hormuz is a narrow waterway that connects the Persian Gulf to the Gulf of Oman. These blue waters have been home to fishermen and pearl divers, and they've long been an important route for global oil supplies. At its narrowest point, the strait is only 21 miles wide. This area has been a flashpoint for tensions between Iran and the U.S.
Good evening. With President Obama just hours away from delivering his final State of the Union speech in the capital.
In 2016, Iran intercepted two American Navy boats after they entered Iranian waters and detained 10 U.S. service members.
10 American sailors and their boats are being held right now by Iran.
The sailors were released unharmed a few hours later. But more recently, tensions have been running high once again. The U.S. military says Iran has either seized or attempted to take control of nearly 20 internationally flagged ships in the region over the past 2 years. American officials now say they are taking additional steps to counter what they see as Iranian provocations. Nehsan Rafati is senior Iran analyst at the International Crisis Group.
They've announced that they're sending F-16s, F-35s, naval assets, a marine expeditionary unit.
And now the U.S. says it's sending armed Navy personnel to guard ships passing through the strait. Rafati says this kind of escalation comes with risks.
The concerns are obviously significant whenever you have a lot of moving military parts in a very, very small and, you know, risk-prone area.
Rafati says in 2019, Iran started taking more provocative actions against shipping in the strait. This was a response to U.S. sanctions against Iranian oil exports. Iran uses the seized ships as leverage in negotiations with the West. But the idea of sending American military forces to guard commercial ships in the Persian Gulf is not completely new, says Dalia Dasakei. She's a senior fellow at the Berkel Center for International Relations at the University of California, Los Angeles. She says during the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, oil tankers were registered as U.S. carriers, and the U.S. provided escorts for them as they moved through the Persian Gulf. That's called reflagging.
There were, you know, multiple hearings in the U.S. Congress about what would be the risks, you know, would deterrence work, what if it didn't work. And in fact, even at that time, Senator Joe Biden was on the cautious side, worried that U.S. reflagging could lead to direct conflict with Iran.
This time, however, she says there is little public debate in Washington about the risks and benefits of the new U.S. deployments.
I think one of the reasons is that when you have a context with Iran advancing its nuclear program, supporting Russia in Ukraine, the, you know, abysmal domestic situation and repression at home, there's just not a lot of appetite, I think, in Washington right now to relieve any pressure on the Iranians.
Gerald Feierstein, former U.S. ambassador to Yemen and now head of the Arabian Peninsula program at the Middle East Institute, says there are still many unanswered questions.
How many troops are you talking about? What kind of weapons would they carry? What would be their rules of engagement?
Feierstein says it's also not clear which commercial ships the U.S. would provide security for. The Pentagon did not respond to my questions about these deployments. In recent months, diplomatic discussions between Iran and the U.S. have failed. President Donald Trump walked away from the Iran nuclear deal signed during the Obama administration, and no other deal has been reached so far. Emma Ashford is with the Stimson Center, where she works on U.S. foreign policy.
We have seen some indications from both the U.S. and the Iranians that they're interested in trying to dial down tensions, particularly on the nuclear issue, but that does not seem to have improved the regional tensions.
On Saturday, Naval Commander Alireza Tangsiri discussed Iran's new military capabilities in the Persian Gulf.
موشک‌هایی که در این الحاق داشتیم در واقع افزایش برد داشتند.
He said Iran is deploying drones and missiles with longer ranges and better precision. Iranian military officials have long complained about the presence of American forces in the Persian Gulf. Meanwhile, U.S. Marines and sailors have already been deployed to nearby Bahrain, and they are expected to start their work soon. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Usually, a rise in women's employment and a country's GDP go hand in hand. But India is bucking that trend. The number of women in the workforce has declined drastically over the past few years, even as India's economy has risen to become the world's fifth largest. From Mumbai, Raksha Kumar reports.
Renu Rai Yelgaonkar grew up in Mumbai's favorite weekend getaway, a hill station called Lonavala. She and her five siblings lived on just her father's income. This propelled her to take extra jobs. Even as a student at Pune University, she began teaching school kids math and science in the evenings for some extra income.
My maiden family was quite middle class, and then that was the reason that I used to work.
She started with just two students, but within a couple of years, she had 82 children queuing up to learn from her. But life had other plans.
I got that scholarship and I went to England because that was out of my family's budget.
While in England, she was completing her management studies, working on designing psychometric tests for new recruits in companies. And she met her husband, who is from a wealthy political family in central India. That changed everything.
Since this family was really well-to-do and there was no financial need also to, you know, that I should go and earn for the family was not the first priority.
Yelgaonkar's experience is common to an entire generation that benefited from the opening up of India's economy in the early 1990s. Middle-class families were propelled to wealth. Vibhuti Patel is a former gender studies scholar at the Tata Institute of Social Sciences in Mumbai. She says as families became wealthier, women did not feel the need to work.
The male wages also increased and male salaries increased. They withdrew women from the workforce that we will manage in one salary.
Prosperity in that unique way kept Indian women from working outside their homes. Another unusual reason for declining rates of women's participation in the workforce is more and more women getting educated.
So India produces the maximum number of women graduates in the world.
Sairi Chahal runs an online platform called SheRose that helps women with employment and entrepreneurship. As opposed to other countries where education for women translates to their employment, Chahal says the situation is different in India. Women who are educated join the workforce, but drop out when family responsibilities take over.
We all know people who have great careers in their 20 to 30 decade, but by the time they reach 30, 35 decade, you know, dropping off from their careers. And by the time it reaches 40, 50, it's a very thin pipeline.
Nandita Bedi graduated with an economics degree from Delhi University. She'd worked at an organization that would influence IT policy in the 1990s when the internet was just making inroads into India.
I was in Delhi when I got married. It was 1995. My husband was in Calcutta then. So after I got married, I moved across to Calcutta.
When she found out about her pregnancy, she decided to stay at home for her daughter.
At that point, I thought, you know, because I didn't want to leave my child and, you know, step out. And I wasn't happy with the idea.
Gender studies scholar Vibhuti Patel says something else has changed in India in recent years.
Gender stereotypes also have been so consolidated in the current right-wing shift. The kind of media machinery that you have, how women are valorized as a homemaker. So that valorization of man as a breadwinner, that concept is now becoming more consolidated.
Although many women in India have in fact dropped out of the labor force, experts say that the numbers are misleading because of the number of women who actually work in informal economies. They get paid small amounts in cash and don't get included in the GDP. Amongst women who work in the informal sector, many were employed in agriculture and livestock industries. In the past, they contributed to family incomes significantly. However, jobs are shrinking in those sectors, says economist Nisha Srivastava.
Even in smaller districts and in poorer regions, agriculture is very highly mechanized, which has a lot of women unemployed. The opportunities for men is that they can migrate.
But migrating to another town is not always an option for women, since they are often the primary caregivers at home. Women's safety while commuting to work is also a major concern. Another reason for fewer women in the workforce is mechanization. As the Indian economy grows, machines are replacing more and more jobs. Vibhuti Patel, the gender studies scholar, says when the number of available jobs shrink, men are prioritized for them.
Women are the first victim of the changes which are coming up in the production processes.
The United Nations says that the economic growth of a country is closely tied to women's participation in its economy. Sairi Chahal from the platform She Rose says jobs are not a policy priority in India. But when women work, the results are transformative.
At an individual level, it's just life-changing because when you put money in hands of a woman, you're basically creating a positive situation for the whole family. You know, children get better education, better healthcare, better savings, better safety net.
To bring women back into the workforce, apart from focusing on safer commute and childcare options, all the experts I spoke to say that the nation should address the prevalent outlook, which considers women's employment less important than men's. For The World, I'm Raksha Kumar in Mumbai.
Now, a story about hope and disappointment in the Women's World Cup. We start with the disappointment, depending on which side you're rooting for.
Right, puts it over the bar.
Megan Rapinoe's penalty kick for Team USA in Melbourne, Australia yesterday, it soared over the net. It would be the 38-year-old's last World Cup kick. Moments later, Sweden clinched the win and sent the U.S. team home early. Another team is making a different kind of history, though. Cue that Women's World Cup theme, please. The team from Morocco, the Atlas Lionesses, play France tomorrow. The Moroccan women were the first Arab or North African team ever to qualify for the Women's World Cup. On Thursday, they beat mighty Colombia to secure a spot in the knockout round. The French team is ranked number 5 in the world. Morocco is ranked 72, the former colonizer and colonized countries squaring off. If Morocco wins tomorrow, expect to hear a lot of sounds like this. This was recorded on the street in Casablanca last December, when the Moroccan men's team defeated Morocco's other colonizer, Spain, in the 2022 Men's World Cup. Those sounds reverberated across the Arab world. And with that, we've reached the end of Our Match today. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other, and we'll see you tomorrow.